Welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed your sumptuous lunch. Jane, what do you want to talk about now?
Hey, thanks, Patricia. The rest of the afternoon is really sort of building on the elements of the scope that we talked about earlier. And it was mentioned about the impact isn't just that there's a rate that's set by some sort of body, but also there's got to be a link to the mechanism as to how the entity can recover costs, whether it's in service or an incentive-based regulation. There's got to be some sort of mechanism. And paper 6B highlights some of the mechanisms that were described in the responses to the request for information that was published. As I mentioned earlier when I did the summary of the responses, every single response indicated that there was some system to track certain accounts, certain costs, in order that they can be built into the future rate, whether it's an automatic building or a longer-term building. So paper 6B is just a very brief summary of some of these mechanisms, and paragraph 3 in particular highlights the most common mechanisms that came through in those responses. And what I'd like to do in this paper is to really get your views as to whether this should be an area that we really try and focus in on in the discussion paper, because it does seem to be the common factor and a way of trying to ensure that the rights attached to the rate regulation, I hesitate to use the word guarantee, but lots of other people have
assure.
Used it, assure,
assure
yeah. that these costs will be recovered. So what I'd like to do is get you to talk to me again, because I'm being conscious that I usually talk too much, and I'm not going to do so. So I just want to get your views whether you think this is a good area to focus on to help us develop the scope, because at the end of the day, I think, as Mary highlighted, one of the questions we've got to ask is, does the rate regulation create assets and liabilities within the scope of the conceptual framework or not to use that as a straitjacket, but just to give us a starting point or some guidance as to where we go with these things. Alternatively, do you think that the scope of the discussion should really cover more aspects of those rights and obligations? So, in which case, it is a different creature that we will be dealing with. This obviously is a mechanism, it's something that's more tangible. A few people this morning, and Karen in particular in Ontario, said it's something that's more auditable, it's more transparent, it's more visible for people to latch on to. So at that point, I'll open it up to get your view. Dennis, you had your card up first.
My reaction is that these variance accounts are sort of integrated into what you described as your mechanism. There's a rate-setting mechanism, which a part of that is the variance account. So having a scope aspect associated with this may be duplicative. Or another observation is, what about the aspect of fixed assets, PP&E, right? Plenty of things in there that are rate regulated but really aren't labeled as a variance account, right? So if an entity had, for whatever reason, doesn't have any variance accounts, does that mean even though they have the PP&E differences, does that mean then they're outside the scope, right? If everything ran as is, you wouldn't want to say, gee, they're no longer rate regulated, right? So my perspective would be not necessarily in the scope, maybe move it to recognition and measurement as an aspect of the variance being the support, the authority of the rate regulator acknowledging these variance accounts and ensuring that they're part of future rates in recognition and measurement, but having the scoping aspect be this mechanism with the rate regulator body established through statute or the contract.
But would you mind if I just ask a follow-up on that? You know, I think in advance of this meeting, thinking about some of the feedback and description of rate regulation, one of the things that I'm concerned about is so many, it's a really big tent when you say rate regulation, and we probably don't want to try and put everything that's in the tent, you know, within the scope of consideration here. And so while anybody who has a variance account, I agree with your assertion or assumption that everybody who has a variance account would have rate regulation, but I don't know that everybody who has some form of rate or price regulation would have to have tracking for variance accounts. And I think using this as maybe an indicator of a place where you could start to draw the line, because substantive price regulation may be too broad.
Well, a reaction that haven't flushed all of it out, but is, okay, fine, you can go in to evaluate rate accounting, but if you can't get past recognition and measurement where you have the regulator giving you the guarantee of recovery, then you can't recognize the asset. You can record the liability. So you can evaluate, meet the scope, but then when you come to recognition and measurement, it might be zero.
Would you want to pick up maybe a very, very wide range of activities that might then be subject to some disclosure or other considerations in ongoing evaluation of that?
Personally, no. But I would say that the scope can be broad, but okay. In my eyes, the narrowing happens in recognition.
But if we put the narrowing in recognition and measurement, then anybody who's within the scope gets subject to potentially other aspects of it. That's the trade-off.
I understand.
Can I chip in there? No, I wanted to make this very similar comment as Dennis. And I'd like to go back to the 79 letters. If I remember, there are two coming from Poland, where one day explaining, you know, for a couple of pages the regulatory systems, and at the end it says, but the regulator does not allow us to recognize regulatory assets and liabilities or to recover those extra costs that we have incurred. So, well, if you look at the definition, maybe there would be a rate regulated entity. But the objective is, okay, fine, you're rate regulated, but how does it help you to have a standard if you're not allowed, you know, to recognize the asset and liabilities? Because the regulator says you shall not be allowed to do it. You fix your rate and you're done. So are we scoping those entities or not? You know, it's a bit long, you know, what you're saying. You know, maybe they should be in, or maybe they shouldn't be in. I don't think they should be in if they have no rights to recover any extra. I think the issue that we have in the industry is to recognize the asset and liabilities.
They have no right, or it's...
The regulator said you're not allowed. It's never been allowed. Maybe because Eastern Europe is just new.
It's new.
So maybe it's going to take them another 20 years to be allowed to recover that. I don't know.
We have no...
Therefore, do we scope them in?
We have to train a regulator.
Train the regulator. All right. I'm listening.
Some countries and stuff, and I mean, it took only 4 months. I think it's a new system, so it has been long discussions to explain mechanism and to explain, and that's why this was implemented in France, but there was no question about that because there was no regulation in place and no stable, I would say, principle of regulations. It was still like a commercial discussion, may I put this amount, which kind of expand, and so on. So now it's over, so we know exactly what is it and so on. So I think it's, I don't know, Poland, I didn't have time to read the answer, but maybe it's just because it's new regulation or...
Correct. So, but at this stage, even if there would be a standard that says if you meet criteria 1, 2, 3, you can recognize the asset and liabilities. If the regulator says you cannot, well, I think in that case, it's not going to help.
The value would be zero. So
is it a measurement issue or a recognition issue?
Sounds like the board on conceptual.
That's right.
Yes. As I said before, for me, this is the main question is, if purely is, I think it's necessary to understand which is your understanding of what is a variance for deferral account. Reading this paper, I understand that this is a very specific, it is a explicit account that you recognize in the case, for example, you have PASCOS that has been higher than expected, and the regulator recognized you the right to recover that cost using future tariffs. So, for example, we were explaining or discussing in the during the lunch in the case of energy transport infrastructure, if you had an accident in a transmission tower and you had to replace that transmission tower, so you can capitalize that transmission tower because you have that right to recognize the or to recover that cost against future revenues. But from my point of view, the discussion should be wider, not so narrow. So, and I will go through some of the examples I had put on the table after the lunch. For example, let me explain you a case. You have that old road, you are operating that old road, and then the government says, no, we are concerned because we had a lot of traffic jams, and we would like to make a widening. So we like to build two new lanes. But we cannot increase tariffs now because we had economic crisis and we have problems with the users. So the agreement is we will increase the period of the on the concession and we will increase the tariffs for the next 10 years. After 10 years, we will not increase now the tariffs, but after 10 years, we will increase the tariffs according with this agreement. Applying this, you will obtain a rate of return, let me say, 7%, 8%. Okay. And the question is, how do you register that agreement? And the question especially is, what happened with the profit and loss account? Because if you build the new lanes, you will have depreciation, you will have financial expenses after the construction, and you will have big losses and no profit because you are not recognizing the tariffs. So what I am proposing, and I understand that could be discussed in this case, I think there is a regulatory asset that is the right you had in the future to charge tariffs to recuperate that expenses, to recover that expenses. And I think this is something that is wider than you are discussing here, because here I think we are speaking about past costs, not future investments, and the discussion why past costs and not future investments. And this discussion of the road, it can be applied for other assets. Because the question here, as I said before, is that you have a rate of return, and the question is that the tariffs are not free, are fixed by a regulator. And normally, the customers has an implication in the, as happened in the example I had put on the table about that widening of the toll road.
My colleague Mary Tokar said how big the tent should be and who is going to be in the tent we are going to take into consideration. Pardon me for saying this, but Jesus, don't you think your fact pattern of widening the road and laying the extra lane is taken care of in IFRIC 12?
No, but the question is, this was discussed in IFRIC 12 and the conclusion, because the problem, in IFRIC 12 you had an intangible in this case because you had demand rates.
So, but you said you're going to expense it. That's what I'm. That's when I listed my.
You spend. You had to build the new lines.
Yeah.
You had to spend money. You had to finance. So you had to obtain financing from a bank. The bank is financing you because you had an agreement with the government, and they say that you will recover this amount against tariffs next 20 years. Okay. But the problem is now with the IFRIC 12. Now the problem is that you had big losses during the at the beginning of the contract. Because as tariffs has been fixed for the future, now the expenses you have, now the financial expenses you have, the financial expenses you have, the OPEX related to the new lanes, and you have the depreciation of that lane, but you don't have revenue, and that now is not resolved in IFRIC 12.
Yeah, but
this was discussed. Sorry, but in this same room, I was 10 years ago discussing about IFRIC 12, and we discussed the same question, and they say, no, we agree this is something that has to be discussed, but as we are now dealing with an interpretation, this could be a question that will be discussed if the concept of an asset is open in the framework. So I think that's the moment to discuss this.
Last point on this, apologies. The thing we need to think about, and I think it's a good point you raised, but are we trying to overlap IFRIC-12 scope into this, and thereby are we breaching into IFRIC-12? Is that an issue that we need to deal with in IFRIC-12? I know from your point of view, it doesn't matter whether it's IFRIC-12 or RIC regulated, you want the right answer to be reflected. But my question to you is that we are talking scope here. Should we think about that the scope issue that we need to deal with in IFRIC-12, or should we bring it into rate regulated? Because I'm just worried.
But this problem is not only
related. You already touched on it in an earlier conversation. Are we expanding the scope? And my worry is that this is going
to. But again, I think this.
That addresses this very issue.
Give me a plain question.
I think you got an answer.
This question is not only.
Very worked up, that's why I'm helping.
Oh, but the question is not related only with the IFRIC-12 and with concessions, because you can have the same problem in some type of regulated activity where you don't have concessions. For example, in the case of an airport, because concession, one main question is that you have to make the reversion to take back the asset to the government at the end of the contract. And this is the main issue of a concession. You are not the owner of the asset. You are operating the asset. The owner of the asset is the government. But for example, you had an airport, it's a Heathrow airport. Heathrow is an asset that is owned by the company. It's not owned by the government. So you don't have concession. But you don't have the same question. You fix a rate of return. Well, the rate of return is fixed by the regulator. And the tariffs are fixed according with the decision with the customers. And there is a mismatch between the return and the tariffs. And this means that at the beginning of the regulation period, you had less profits, and at the end of the regulation period, you have higher profits. But it could be the different. For example, this is because normally the tariffs are increased more than inflation. But now we are discussing that the regulator is asking for reduction of tariffs. So in this case, will be the other part. You will recognize to a liability, because the tariffs you are going to recover at the end of the regulation period will be lower than at the beginning of the regulation period. So I think that what I am proposing is not only related with concessions, it's related with regulated activities. One of these regulated activities are concessions.
Mary, did you want to come in?
I did ask, this is a clarification point relating to this variance account point. I think in one of the papers, Jane had made the point that cost of service can be expressed as a rate of return, and then the focus is more on what are the components of the cost that you're calculating the rate of return on. And I'm assuming that when you talk about having variance accounts, the variance may relate to what the capital cost is. As an example, it doesn't have to be deferred revenue or deferred expense as such. So, with that in mind, and thinking about how rate of return tariffs are set for toll, let's keep using the toll roads example, just factually, how specific, when you go in for a review of rates, is there a review of tariffs throughout the life of the concession in terms of whether you're hitting the expected returns, and if not, how explicit is the examination of why not, and how much is there a linkage between change in rates and the explicit drivers for not meeting the tariff? Just how does it work?
It really depends on the asset. Normally, for example, in the case of an airport as Heathrow, where they are at full capacity, there is not demand risk, or this is not very significant because it's an asset that is full. So you have 70 million of users every year, and it's difficult to increase that level. No? So you don't have risk in relation with that. But for example, you can have some type of, as you have service requirements, for example, if the queues are more than 5 minutes, and a percentage of queues are more than 5 minutes, you will have to pay a penalty, and that will be included within all the revenue you are obtaining. So you don't have a fixed rate of return, but the final rate of return that you are obtaining is very similar to the rate of return that has been definitively fixed by the regulator.
And in the toll roads, typically, take France or Italy, maybe not necessarily Spain, is the tariff fixed once at the beginning for the whole life of the concession and not revisited? Or is it subject to periodic?
No, it's different. In the case, for example, of the airport, it's every 5 years. And in the case of toll roads, normally it's initially fixed according with the estimation of investment and future use of the toll road. But in any case, there are renegotiations, as in the case I explained to you. There is a decision from the government saying, no, I want to make a widening.
But those are modifications.
There's a modification that normally means trying to make now the investment, but you recover the investment in the future, because now we cannot increase the tariffs because we had a problem with the user, and the politicians say they will not vote me. So that's the reason. And that's a question of profitability, and that decision not to increase the tariffs now means that you will have to recognize losses in the initial years. And I think that's a question that has to be discussed, because finally it's a discussion about revenue recognition in regulated activities. It's a wider discussion rather than a discussion about the variance of federal accounts. So I think my proposal is that the discussion should be wider.
Can I throw in a quick comment directly to that point?
Bye, Karen.
Thank you. Sorry, in Ontario, the regulator has, under statute, the ability to use any method or device to set rates in both the electric power and natural gas context. So it's not specifically restricted to setting rates based on cost of service or some form of variant thereof, and I'll include incentive returns. So we typically don't have many examples of something different than a cost-based rate or an incentive rate. And maybe I'll ask Craig from the FERC, or sorry, Brian Craig from the FERC to elaborate on this, but certainly in the United States as it relates to the interstate pipeline business and notably gas, and I'm thinking of a Kern River situation many years ago, Brian, the FERC will take into account the different financing structures on a pipeline, and in particular, I believe, if memory serves, they will look at an independent project-like financing where you've got a ton of debt up front and that debt is amortized through the term so that the capital structure does not remain static over the life of the investment, and that rates can be flexible to reflect different financing arrangements in that regard. So just bringing it back to Canada, I think I agree with what the previous speaker was saying, that we do have the regulator has the capacity to use any method or device. And the effect on the accounting statements, whether it's the income statement, cash flow, or balance sheet, often does transcend just reg assets and liabilities.
Brian, do you want to comment?
CC explained it quite well. It's not just in the natural gas industry. We have project-based financing, even in the electric industry, too. So the regulator has many tools by which it can set that rate. And it does take in consideration the project financing and how that is in structuring the rate, particularly in the gas industry. They got rates that are structured back on cost of service, but they also got some rates that are structured based on trackers, too.
Jane.
Thanks. I'd just like, if I could, to again clarify a couple of points, particularly Jesus was explaining, but I think it's relevant to what Karen and Brian have just described as well. And it's where you say the regulator can't increase the tariff now because of the economic situation, but they appreciate that you still need to recover those costs and make your rate of return. So they've got different mechanisms they can use, which is to reopen the tariff negotiations. They can extend the life of the tariff period to give you a longer chance to recover those. But in order to do that, am I correct in thinking you still need to have some sort of mechanism, a tracker account, to know that you're not recovering your costs in the way that was originally agreed with the regulator? So you still need to keep a track of those so that you know whether the future changes will allow you to get back on track, so that at the end of the period you should be back at a
where you expect it to be.
Yes, I think.
So just Jesus, and then we'll come back to you, Karen.
Okay, great. Thanks.
You have demand risks. You say like you don't know what which will be the number of users of the toll road in the future, but you make an estimation.
Yeah.
And you can say this is probable or more likely than not, or let me say, but the question is that you have the right to recover that expenses with future tariff.
Yeah.
And the tariffs have been fixed by the government, taking in mind political decisions or the customers' discussion. So you had a mismatch between the expenses and the revenues due to the regulation. It's not a normal business.
Yeah.
It's regulated, and the price has been decided by the government. They say, no, don't worry, because you will continue having the same rate of return. But we will smooth the tariffs to the future in order to meet our political needs.
Yeah, but there's still a way of you tracking your costs and expenses to make sure that it does flow through.
But you had a right to recover that expenses with future tariffs. And my question is, that right can be recognized in the financial statement of the regulated company?
Mary, did you?
I was just saying, I'm not, Jane keeps saying, but you have some kind of tracker mechanism. I'm not sure that there is in some of the toll road concessions. I think it's you bring arguments to the table when you are, let's say, facing a modification and a renegotiation of rates.
Mm-hmm.
But as Jesus has been saying, the operator takes the demand risk so that if there's not the volume of traffic to achieve the target return rate, that demand risk shortfall falls to the operator. And so, therefore, it doesn't become a basis for another revision of tariffs.
Right. Okay, thank you.
That's right. Because if you have that right,
you're left with
you will have a financial asset.
Yeah.
Because you will have a right
yeah.
to receive, an unconditional right to receive cut from
right.
the government.
Right.
Karen, did you want to comment?
I did, and I'll answer Mary's question as well. Oh, so to your answer question, Jane, the answer is yes. So there would be a tracker account. So let's say you put a very large asset into, you're required to build a large asset. It would cause rate shock. So the regulator would say, we're going to allow you to transition that asset in over a five-year period. But the law in Canada is quite clear that you cannot deprive the utility of its reasonable return on the capital employed by not allowing it to put it in rate base and charge. So they would create a tracker account where the utility would be able to track and track all of its costs associated with that asset because it has spent the cash on it, and that would include the equity return, cost of debt, any taxation liabilities, and those amounts would be then amortized into rates over a future period. So yes, they do absolutely have a tracker account. So you recognize that would allow the utility to report non-cash earnings, but the cash would not be coming in until the recovery period begins. So it spends the money in the asset day one, recovers the earnings or cash flow over the future, but in the meantime, it is reporting non-cash earnings, and that's quite important. It provides the income stability from an earnings perspective that the capital market's looking for. With respect to the demand risk, that was Mary's question. And this comes back to my comment about any method or device. If the regulator and the utility and the public interest dictates that the demand risk should not be borne by the entity, whether it's a toll road or the utility or whatever the regulated entity is, it is possible to structure the regulatory arrangement such that that demand risk is captured in a tracker account. So this is what we mean by the scope with any method or device. We have some utilities in Canada that have weather protection. They have interest rate protection. They have number of customer unit protection. And so the more protections that you have, the presumption is the lower the return on equity is that you're going to get. And so what we find with utilities in Canada is that they strive to achieve a middle ground where they are assuming certain risks that are within their control, and risks that are beyond management control typically would have a deferral or tracker account. But again, this comes back to the fact that there's tremendous flexibility within the regulatory arrangement, and the regulator, generally speaking, has the ability to approve the flexible arrangement. Again, coming back to this notion of any method of advice.
Dwayne has been waiting very patiently.
Yeah, I forgot what I was originally going to say. So, Dennis, I think you had raised the question, you have to have the deferral accounts in order to define a scope, and or is that more in the detail? And I'm not sure you need, and my comment originally was going to be, I'm not sure you need the deferral accounts if we introduce some of the other concepts that we talked about before launch to expand this list. If it's just, there's a regulatory body, and they set rates that bind customers, then I'm thinking, well, maybe you do need some sort of a cause and effect kind of relationship. And I think the deferred account, that's implicit in this deferred or variance or tracking or some account. And maybe that's more of a conceptual way to frame it as opposed to an account. I don't know if that, I know in the U.S. we were concerned about what you meant by accounts, because if we're talking about a very specific, you know, T account where we're keeping track, as opposed to there is a reconciliation of some sort, but it's not necessarily in a GL or in a some ledger in the sky, but there is a periodic true-up or reconciliation of return, or, you know, that may not be a deferred account, and deferred kind of leaves the impression that we're still talking about costs, and I think if we're really trying to broaden this to be not just cost-based, since that didn't work 3 years ago, and it's not covering the predominance of all the arrangements out there, then I would say, can we make it more conceptual? There's a reconciliation, there's a true-up, you know, something like that, and not get into deferral or variant, you know, type of discussion. But, and I don't know if that would help where you were coming out at all or not.
Sure could. I think, isn't the mechanism, the rate-setting mechanism, inherent in reconciliation, account, all of those same things? Isn't that...
Well, I don't think just because you have rates for gaps, you just book a steady rate of return. My paradigm is Fast 71. I mean, we don't, just because you fall under 71 doesn't mean you just have net income that
right.
gets you a steady rate of return. It you book the assets and liabilities when you have a right under some precedent or tracker or reconciliation, or when you're required to refund. Amounts. You're not always required to refund over collections or weather. Some jurisdictions do, some don't. To the point made about some utilities are protected from weather, some aren't, but when we say protected, it's also benefiting from. It can go either way. So, anyway, I'm not sure that helps a whole lot, but the concepts of reconciliation and cause and effect might be a different way to
Memoir.
I'm just talking about the costs that need to be captured in the deferral account. Would that be any other kinds of what is meant by the cost? In fact, for our case, we have some kind of the cost is not actually the money spent. We already spent, but the differences just arise because of the time of recognition. Say, for example, because of the fair valuations of the derivative, or retranslations of some of the foreign exchange, there will be unrealized exchange gain loss. But for the rate setting, the rate regulator only recognized realized gain loss or gain upon settlement. So under rate regulations, those unrealized exchange gain loss need to be deferred, not put through the rate regulations. So under rate regulatory accounting, we need to defer those unrealized exchange. But looking at the deferred accounts definitions is more linked towards what actually the entity expends, but from what those differences does arise because of the recognitions requirements of existing IFRS and those required by the rate regulators, there will be differences. will that differences also allow to be captured under the deferral account in the future account rate setting? Just understand. Because for those companies or entities that have hatching activities, the amount of, if they are not allowed to have the, not eligible for hatch accounting, that fair valuation gain loss will affect the vulnerability of the profit and loss, and that is not really the purpose of any regulations or the purpose of
just to go along with what she's saying, in Canada we have the same type of regulatory assets and liabilities. It's for the asset retirement obligation, pension costs, and deferred taxes. The regulator will, most of the regulators in Canada will allow you to recover those costs only on a cash basis. So you said, well, okay, so I've got a difference between my cash and my accrual basis. So you know eventually your accrual will go through your cash. So you said, well, should I be allowed to set up a regulatory asset for that item that has not been recovered yet? And that's what we are doing in Canada. Probably also in the U.S. for the ones that are only on a cash basis, probably less likely, probably that you have less of those cases, but it's the same. So it's the same issue here. You talk about the functional currency or the
it's not really the cost.
Not yet in the past, but it will come in the past.
That's
just
right.
A timing issue. So you have the ones which are rubber stamped, the one that will soon be rubber stamped, and you have those ones which are far, you know, looking, saying, am I allowed to recover those costs or not?
Michael, did you want to ask a question?
I did, and I think I wanted to ask Karen, but I think it perhaps will help me understand how Karen's experience relates to what Manoir's just described, and that is, Karen, you talked about when there's a requirement to build a significant capital asset, but that the rate doesn't get increased for immediately, it would be bled in over a number of years. Now, you said that costs would be accumulated in a tracker account, which would then be, I think you said, sort of amortized to profit or loss over the future periods. And I wanted to understand, what is the cost that is accumulated in this tracker account? Is it the construction cost itself, or is it the amortization of the capital asset when it starts to be used?
Oh, it depends. So I know of situations where large power plants have been constructed and are placed in service because they are used and useful, but the collection of the full revenue requirement associated with that plant would cause rate shock. So what happens is that the large items relating to capital is your largest cost, followed by depreciation. They would phase the full recognition of those costs into rates over a five-year period. So let's say in year one, after the thing goes in service, 20% of those two costs are realized in rates on a cash basis. The second year, it would go up to 50%, then 75%, and then, you know, whatever the period is, so that by the end of the fourth year or the fifth year, you're recognizing 100% of the costs of service in rates. Now, the company needs to be held harmless from the rate profile. You don't have the right to deprive them of their reasonable opportunity to earn the return. So you can't simply say, we want you to build it, but we're not going to let you put it in rates. And so they have the right to accrue the capital, the debt costs, the equity costs, and the depreciation. The operating costs of the assets, if it's transmission or distribution, might be quite small. And they may well go into rates at the beginning. So it really depends. It's a customized regulatory solution. People tend to use those types of tools lightly because they do cause problems. But the key issue is not to burden the generation of users or customers who happen to be customers at the time a large build is required. And then any amounts that's capitalized over that four-year period may well be amortized over an even longer period in terms of total recovery. Does that help?
Yeah, you know, situations like that in the U.S. were very common in the 80s and 90s when very large nuclear power plants were being built. And and I just provide this for context, there arose some nervousness in the accounting profession that if regulators are constantly pushing the recovery of these things out, is there really substance to the ultimate recovery? And in the U.S., they passed a rule on phase-in plan accounting and basically said that you cannot defer capital costs. You can't take depreciation in the current period for an operating asset and say, no, I'm going to phase that in over a long period of time. And it was done to put some constraints on the regulators who were and Brian is not the FERC that was doing this. It was state regulators.
Oh, it was a lot of state commissions.
But, you know, the accountant said, well, wait a second. We're getting a little uncomfortable with the amount of these charges that are being deferred and how far out they're going and whether we have divorced substance of the economics from the accounting. And the phase-in plan accounting, FAS 92 was put into place to put some guardrails around that. So I think, you know, what Karen describes is absolutely accurate and it happens, but, you know, we had a concern in the U.S. that we might lose the real connection between costs and rates and put some guardrails around the ability to do that over too long a period of time.
Okay, Pascal, you've been waiting.
I've been patient. Yes, I think we should focus about what you call time indifference because of the revenue of rate regulation, and I think it's very important to understand that this timing has resulting from the rate regulation, and because. For us, we've mentioned that it's important to have stability in earnings, and why we want to book asset and liabilities is just to reflect the fair presentation of the earnings. But when I am puzzled about the scope, and I have a large experience of IFRIC 12 too, and so I know IFRIC 12 is different because, as I mentioned, you have a timing, or you have a maturity for the tariff. But as Jesus mentioned, in the tariff, you could discuss for expenses which are made at the beginning, so you have a right to charge, so you book an intangible asset. But at the same time, you could say that you will charge a fee and you have to make the expense at the end of the contract. For renewals, for example. Another time, you know that you are already in the tariff. You know that you have to make a third line in the highway. So you always have a question of matching of what is in the tariff and cost. And that's key in IFRIC 12. That's key for retribution business, I would say, but that's key for when we have a nuclear plant. Each time we sell 1 megawatt of power, we book a liability for the waste of the nuclear. Or I'm not talking about the dismantling asset. I'm talking about accrual, about what expenses we have to expense and to cash out when we have, it's a question of matching of revenues and expenses. That's why, for me, it's very important to be very clear that it's not because it's rate regulation, it's because the rate regulation mechanism does create a mismatch or a timing difference between revenues and cost. And due to rate regulation mechanism, we have a right to enforce such debt, or we have an obligation to pay back the liability, which is different if you are in a merchant. You have the right, you can discuss, but it's you have discussion, so unless you have a claim and you have the right to enforce the claim, you don't have the asset.
But because of the rate regulation, you create that first reason, and the other reason is the timing. Because I think for IFRIC 12, we have concessions and tariff would be set up for 25 years, for example. So we have to of course, we could have discussion, but we will make an assessment of what we're going to expense. And that's the same, I think, for rate regulation. Assets, because we're talking about expenses, but assets are usually long life assets. So, and some mechanisms are set up for four, five years. So it's really more, I think, a question of timing difference and than a question of the, I don't know, the word I think is important to understand that. That's my comment to all other comments. And I have a question. I didn't get what you said about, because I said it's a question of recognition, it's not a question of, it's a question of measurement and not a question of recognition about the asset, because maybe you could have the right mechanism, but if it doesn't work, you have the right, but it's a right for zero. you just tell me that it's not an asset. I think somebody raised a very, I would say, good question at Amsterdam about deferred tax. Remember that? Yes, she doesn't want to answer.
I don't want to remember that.
No, because I think it's deferred tax. I don't know if it's an asset or liability, but you book the amount only for what you think you will recover in IFRS, not in US GAAP, but for IFRS. I know that, and it's also a timing difference to get the right impact. I would say to match the income in P&L impact, the tax impact in the P&L, and the income impact. Just sorry for that. Thanks.
I asked you not to mention IS 12.
I didn't. No, he mentioned pensions. You want to discuss pensions?
Similar issues. Okay.
No, I think Joanne is the one who made this comment about cause and effect, and I heard around the table about this tracker mechanism. I want to ask a question. This is something I've been grappling with. How does this tracker mechanism work? I don't know the answer. I'm just asking a question. How does this tracker mechanism work in an incentive-based system? I just want to understand, because we have to future-proof the scoping so that we take care of it. And maybe I'm incorrect, but I thought the world is moving towards more incentive-based rather than cost-based. In such a scenario, how does this tracker mechanism work? And if anybody has an experience, please illuminate me.
Michelle seems to be
Sharon, so is Duane, I think.
But the incentive base, at least in Ontario and maybe other parts of the country in Canada, you start with a cost of service the first year. That gives you a rate. Then your rate for the following year would be plus inflation, minus a productivity factor, and plus, they call it a Z factor, and the Z factor is to take into account of any costs passed through. That is not in the formula, you'll be allowed to recover it. And any exceptional costs will also be allowed to be recovered in that formula. So the formula includes, you know, all those special items. In fact, and to track all those costs, if that's a tracker or whatever you want to call it, there's different terms. But it's built up in the formula. It's not only, you know, you have a plus 1%, it's plus 1 plus anything else that is not that factor. No, it's clear.
Yeah. I just want to say, the way maybe the stupid accountant in me is thinking through, the tracker account is going to be your asset or a liability.
Correct.
That will be potentially subject to realization and all that good stuff is the basis for your future asset or a liability. In an incentive base, only a portion of it is going to be tracked.
No, same for the others. The other ones, even the cost of service, you said you fix your rate, that's it. If you have a pass-through, the incentive base for cost of service, the pass-through accounts, you're always allowed to recover it. And whether your incentive base or cost of service, that Z factor, those special costs, the storm, that whatever, that or that new asset, you will also be allowed to recover it. So you're going to park it as a regulatory asset, It's allowed, it's in the formula, and the only thing you have to do is go back in front of the regulator, says, okay, this is the cost I've incurred, we'll rubber stamp you. There will be some discussion, but at the end we'll rubber stamp, and say, okay, go on. That meets the criteria that we've set in that Z factor. So, regardless where you're calling the same assets.
Well, can I just clarify that? The Z factor takes specific line costs out of the price cap or incentive regime. So if you have storm costs and you spend $100 million, they come out. They are not subject to annual inflation. So you have a revenue requirement that's set in a cost of service review. Let's say you're staying out for 3 consecutive years. You apply the formula as Michelle has indicated. However, there are certain line items, the variants for which are not subject to an automatic increase under the IRM framework, such as fuel costs. Those are recorded as actual, and any variance to the budget would go to the tracker account. The accounts and numbers and line items for which are carved out of the automatic adjustment up, or another way of saying it, subject to a tracker account, are specifically dealt with in the rate order that accompanies the decision of the board. All of that is known at the time that the board issues its decision on how these specific accounts will be treated. The board will issue an accounting order that specifically sets out how these calculations will occur in the future and over the IRM period specifically. So there is, in effect, pre-approval for the type of cost that will be subject to some form of tracker and the methodology that will occur to dispose of it. And then the board at some point in the future when it's disposing those accounts will simply assure that the accounting occurred, the debits and credits and recording occurred in the way that was agreed on or approved at the time of the original order. So there are carve-outs from the overall inflation of the revenue line, specifically at time zero when the rates or the order of the board is issued and all of the accounting mechanisms are set up.
Thanks. I'm quite conscious here that there's a lot of this is quite Canada-specific, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to ask others around the table if these comments are common to the other parts of the world as well.
Can I jump in, though, with one comment to your question? I mean, for me, it just helps, and we don't have this in my company, but talking to some other folks, so let's just take a totally non-financial based metric that will drive future revenues that are granted by the revenue. So reliability. So we're going to do a fully traditional 100% cost basis as the base tariff. And then based on a historical test year with fuel trackers, I mean, just a very traditional. But then if over the next year your reliability stays below a certain target, we're going to throw in, I'll throw a number, a penny per kilowatt. It's very high, but a penny per kilowatt on top of it. And so I'm at December 31st. And by the way, you won't be able to get that bill for 2 years because we'll there's just a two-year lag. Every year we'll do this, and you'll get it in rates a year or two down the road because we need time to validate whatever it is. And the question is, in this scope, is that a variance account by looking at the reliability metric? It's not an account. It's not a GL account, but it is a calculation that is verifiable to some degree. And is that what we mean in the scope here, or were we limited it to cost? I mean, I keep coming back to, are we really just putting cost base in a different disguise, and or do we really mean incentive base that maybe has nothing to do with a financial metric?
That's and exactly my question.
Right. That's what I'm trying to. But either any of them have a comparison, a reconciliation, a cause and effect that reliability was X, we met our target, that will create future revenues. We're bound, the regulator binds that on the customer 2 years from now, and it's going to stick. And so can we book the asset now?
That's exactly what I'm asking. Thank you for that great clarification.
Yeah,
it's not on the account. It's the whether the incentive in your case, 1 cent per 1 kilowatt, is that qualifying? Is that within the scope? If it's purely incentive-based, forget about it. There's no cost anywhere. is 1 cent for 1 kilowatt on a reliability.
Right.
So now in this scoping, on December 31st, do you have an answer?
Exactly.
That's exactly what I was trying to
say. Now I would like to pick up on Dwayne's point. The companies that FERC regulate, basically the incentive-based regulations is still based on cost. And what it actually does, it may advance the method by which you could recover the cost and provide some incentive on the return, but the bedrock principle is on cost.
Although looking forward to now, that may not always be
the case. That may not always be the case, but as it's been today. And, you know,
but that was the reason for my question, is just checking, because that's very common in America, that it is still very much the cost-based situation, but in other parts of the world, these incentives are becoming
right.
more and more.
It would allow you to get a higher return or advanced recovery, but the foundation is based on your cost of service.
So, in Korea, we are strongly cost-based, right? So the difference between actual cost and the estimated cost shall be settled through adjustment in future rate. So we don't have any incentive-based model in our country.
So your scope would be happily, it's only if it's an actual cost that's already been incurred that is going to be built in for recovery in the future in terms of scope. But again, my question is whether that would satisfy, or because there are more and more incentives built in, do we need to think about the scope being wider than that to also capture Wayne's penny per kilowatt hour incentive, which is not related to an actual cost,
right?
But in terms of the economics, it's a future income that is assured through the regulation.
Yeah, do we match that income to the period in which the operations generated at good reliability, because next year reliability could go all to pot and we don't get that money, but then you could be booking the revenue that period just because that's when you're billing and collecting it versus when did you earn it. And anyway, you get it.
Lily? I think that the mechanism, even if you use the incentive mechanism, it's at the end it's very similar to the cost, because you have the Z which you add to the cost after you put down the incentive component, and I don't think that the mechanism creates uncertainty, a real uncertainty. I think that it shouldn't be the major component of our scope. I think that the most important thing is the size of the demand and the certainty of the demand and these issues that we talked about earlier, because even the incentive mechanism is most of the time will ensure the entity the full cost at the end, unless someone has an example which didn't, but I don't think it is. Okay.
Yes, I agree with you. I think it's very difficult to separate between costs of incentive mechanism. It will depend case by case. Some type of regulation that is called incentive is prepared also to recover the cost. So, although you have some type of incentive to be more effective dealing with the OPEX, for example, or dealing with the level of services, as I told before about the queues in the airport, for example. So it's related. So for me, it's very difficult to say no, only cost of services and not including incentive mechanisms. I had a question for our Canadian and U.S. colleagues. According with your GAAP, financial expenses are included as expenses that can be capitalized in the deferral accounts. Financial expenses related to, for example, building a new tower distribution.
Yeah, so as I said already, we have something called allowance for funds used during construction. So that's basically taking the financing costs and capitalizing it. And this gets back to what Dennis said earlier on. I had exactly the same thought as he did, and that is that we keep talking about deferral and variance accounts, but what about these other things that we take and capitalize? Are they meant to be included within the scope of deferral and variance accounts, or are they going to be treated separately?
But they say financial expenses after you finish the construction.
Well, after we finish construction, there should be no more financial expenses.
But you have to pay to the bank.
No,
financial expenses.
So
because you repay the.
So we're paying for the debt that's occurred with the building.
Uh-huh.
So while we're in construction, we take the financing costs and we capitalize it. Yeah. After we're out of construction, financing is part of your operating costs, no longer capital.
Yes, but it's an expense that is related with an investment. You have to make. To recover with future expenses, could be also capitalized.
Sorry, I'm not sure.
Yes. No, the question is the future revenues are also fixed to recover the financial expenses that you are going to pay to the bank after the construction.
Yeah.
Going into the future, yeah, it'll be over the next 30 years that we will recover that money, yes.
Mary, you wanted a clarification?
I have a kind of a follow-up question. I don't know if Kathy is more related.
Well, no, I was just going to, I mean, I think what Richard explained, to a large part, AFUDC is capitalized interest, and you can capitalize interest under GAAP outside of regulatory accounting. What we are able to do in North America beyond that is to capitalize the cost of the equity component of finance.
Yes.
So if you go build a new power plant, you're going to go 50% debt, 50% equity. The debt piece is pretty straightforward, but you have to go sell stock and you have to pay a dividend on that stock to attract investors. So that equity investment has a cost to the in the rate-making paradigm, right? So Brian would say, well, that dividend is no different than interest. You should attribute the cost of that dividend to the construction of the asset. So while you're building the asset, you debit construction work in process, and you credit income, and then that income piece gets depreciated over the life of the asset, and you get recovery of it, and recovery of a return on it.
Yeah.
So that's what's different than I think any other. That's what's different under regulatory accounting than otherwise.
And Casey, does that presume though that construction work in progress is not in your rate base during the period of construction?
Correct. You wouldn't get two shots of it.
So the reason you're capitalizing during construction is you're not getting any return on that currently. So you get to capitalize it, and then it gets in rate base, and you get the return over the next 30 years, to your point, Richard.
Yes.
Right. And then the commission started this incentive program where they put the CWIP in rate base, as Wayne said, and you get your money up front. And in that way. So it's the two models for how you get to collect that return.
Yeah, no, in that case, you don't get a return. You just get a recovery.
I was going to try and build on the example that Duane gave us before to consider about distinguishing between cost-based variance accounts.
Yep.
And
performance-based.
And performance-based, the reliability example.
Mm-hmm.
And very complicated here because I'm going to try and link it up with the toll roads point that we're talking before, which is I don't know how it works, but let me assume for a minute that 1 cent per kilowatt is you get to charge it in 2015, calendar 2015, and you get 1 cent per whatever number of kilowatts are delivered, so you're taking demand risk on that. You know, and let's say it's lower or higher than what you would expect, that reliability bonus is good for whatever it turns out your sales volume is. Now, and the reason I'm saying characterize it that way or make that assumption is because then it seems a lot more like the target rate of return in the toll roads. What Jesus is taking the demand risk in terms of how many cars will actually use use that toll road, and I think it's, I'm looking at that and saying, would you feel differently about something where it's you taking the demand risk? Is that just a measurement issue in terms of the asset? You know, you say it's this 2013's reliability that earns you the 2015 bonus. Okay. Would you say that estimating what the demand is a measurement issue in terms of recognizing the asset in 2013? Or would you say if you're taking demand risk, that's a reason why you would wait till 2015 to recognize it as earned?
Maybe what you are saying is related with the representation at the beginning, no? I guess it is.
Yeah.
Yes, in the definition you say expected, and now you say capable. No, I think it's the changes you are proposing in the framework, in the definition of an asset, no?
Maybe it is. Because
I'm there, but under GAAP for my utilities.
Not GAAP, but
sorry, under rate making for my utilities. I mean, the theory would be you go in for a rate case every day and true up every day, right? And so my costs today were this, change the rate. My costs were this, change the rate. Well, that's impractical. So you go in rate cases in the period where you start to get out of whack relative to a reasonable rate of return. So the point was I was going to make is today U.S. utilities take demand risk.
Yeah.
Now, I know it was referenced there are certain companies that will go in for a weather rider. There are certain companies in the U.S. that have storm riders. So you take risk of all kinds of stuff that's not going to go exactly as was planned when you set the rate. And they're not all tracked up. They're all trued up to a specific tracker. And so I just, that's just a leveling thing. But
that's
but
when you're recovering
point,
cost.
But the difference is, and this is what I don't know about your situation, either side, if demand was way higher in 15, and we got, if the intent was you should get $1 million of extra in your rates, and weather was so hot that we ended up getting $3 million, the regulator has the right to call us back and say,
oh, yeah,
wait a minute. And then we also have the right to go in if we only got a third of it.
Right.
And say, hey, we were entitled to $1 million.
But that's when it's
but
if, cost.
Can you do that as well?
But that's when it's
renegotiate
cost based. Before we go to that, going to your let's move away from cost based recovery.
No,
to,
but even for to, the reliability.
Okay. Okay. So
if the reliability award was $1 million instead of
okay,
a cent per.
So reliability would be expressed as a revenue
say
target.
A dollar amount.
A revenue target rather than as a. You take demand risk, but it per unit sold, you get X. Because if it says it's $1 million, okay, we aren't going to go back if you get $9.99 or $1 million and you know $1.01 million. But obviously, go in if it was a third or three times the target. So you're saying it's that reliability bonus gets expressed as here's your target extra revenue in total. So that, in essence, becomes something you get to recover.
That's part of your revenue requirement, like any other element of the revenue, I guess is one way to say it. Your question then, should that be an asset? Clearly that gets into recognition and measurement, but
the fact that it's actually expressed as a total target and then you figure out, divided by the expected volume, what that means per unit is different from maybe the target rate of return structure that subtly different, but perhaps importantly, than Jesus is talking about. Okay.
Michael?
Just on that, can I just clarify, are we talking about a reliability revenue target that is independent of what it costs you to achieve that reliability?
Yeah.
Hence, it's not linked to costs incurred.
Right. That's the behavioral example.
Yeah, right.
Purely incentive.
Yeah. Okay, Jane, back to you.
Yeah, keep moving.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just conscious of we're keeping an eye on the clock, and we've got three papers left, but the couple of them are, you know, they're shorter, I think, issues than we've been discussing. So the next paper is paper 6C, which is the identifying the rate regulator. And again, we've touched on this a little bit today, so I won't say too much to start with. But we had a definition in the 2009 exposure draft. It's also in our latest 2013 exposure draft as well, which is focusing on the
the entity interacting with a regulator who's an authorised body that can establish the prices that must be charged to the customers. And part of that definition is that the authorised body is empowered by statute or by a contract to set those rates. And the regulator can be a third party body, an independent third party body, but also the definition talks about it, it's possible that it could be the governing board of the entity itself, if the board is required by statute or contract to set the rates. And we did have some questions coming in about, I think it was a concern that if it's an internal board of governors, does that open it up to entities that are kind of in a monopoly situation and not actually regulated officially, but might then, as maybe a protective measure, just decide themselves that they'll regulate their prices to avoid perhaps some intervention. So I'd just like to get your views, really, in terms of whether we need to be a bit more specific in the definition, whether we need to change the definition. And there's some questions at the end of paper 6C. So questions basically, do you agree that the scope of the planned discussion paper should focus on regulation that is formalised within the statute, overseen by an authorised body? A question that was asked in one or two of the letter, the responses, is should that include farming cooperatives and things like that? So again, moving away from this focus on utilities and thinking about other types of industries or entities, because obviously farming cooperatives, they have an agreement that everybody within the cooperative charges the same sorts of prices. Or do you think that the existing definition is adequate and would be able to carry that forward?
Jacob.
Maybe just a comment on the price. In South Africa, for example, the layout revenue is fixed, and then they calculate the average tariff. But only after that, our company, for example, will put forward a proposal on the different customers, where input is received from the regulator in terms of poor people or other people in terms of your tariffs. So when I just read the definition, I'm just looking at the price I set. In some cases, it's more actually the revenue that is set.
I think also we'll pick up on that in the next paper as well, paper 6B, which is the other aspect of the definition.
Thank you.
My thought is that there has to be something formal about the regulation. I don't think it could be as simple as an entity deciding for themselves that they're either going to set rates or that they're going to create some kind of regulation. I don't think that when any of us sat down to get involved in this whole exercise that we had any intention that it would be that.
So that does it mean it excludes its own governing body like in the US?
Well, I struggled with this whole idea of independent, which is what FAS-71 says, as opposed to the idea that it could be somebody who's inherited an independent mandate. So I think that if it's truly independent, so that there is no connection between the regulator and the regulated utility, which is the case in Alberta. All of the utilities there are invest their own, none of them have anything at all to do with the government. However, that's not the case in most of the rest of Canada. Most of the rest of Canada, we don't believe in socialist governments in Alberta. Most of the rest of Canada, we don't, which means there is some kind of connection between the regulator and the utility. And through the interaction I've had with other utilities, I think that is acceptable. But I would draw the line at where somebody decides for themselves that they're just going to set rates.
Karen, do you want to intervene since they signed Canada?
I'll finish off the view for you. So notwithstanding the fact that I work for government agencies and regulated government utilities, I think that the notion of an independent regulator is important. I'm not as I have difficulty with the notion of a board of the entities simply because of the inherent conflicts of interest that cannot be structurally mitigated or effectively dealt with. So a self-regulatory organization, I have some difficulty with that model because it lacks in respect the moral authority to set rates at the end of the day, and it is inherently conflicted. So I don't know how it would achieve the balance in a credible way of the public interest, which always talks about aligning utility rights with the rights of the customers. So that would be the first. So I don't mind the definitions on page one of page paper 6C, but I do think that the portion of it that relates to the board should probably be removed. The second question at the end of the page or the paper that talks about farming cooperatives, and then we'll back up, and I'm not entirely sure that those types of entities would be in scope for the reason that the customers within a class are not fungible. What I think is a differentiating factor, whether it's natural gas or electric power or even, unless they say, a toll road, the customers are not fungible. You're not dealing with a large, potentially large number of customers who are, for all intents and purposes, from a rate-making perspective, interchangeable. And rate-making does include, of course, different customer classes, usually based on size or load. So I would have difficulty with including in scope those farming cooperatives in number two.
Okay, thank you. Mary?
Question, if the only concern that people have about independent is that it would be difficult to implement when a rate-regulated entity is state-owned, I wanted to remind people about the related party standard and ask whether that is enough of a protection, as it were, in terms of dealing with a rate regulator that might also be a government body when a rate regulated entity has government ownership. So if we were to keep independent, saying this, you know, they can both be owned by the government, but they have to be separate. But that's why the board of directors wouldn't work if the powers were devolved by the government to the board. Do people think that's an operational cut, remembering that we do have a related party standard that requires disclosure of the relationship, how we're both government owned?
About the state-owned enterprises, in Italy, we have this situation because all the rate-regulated entities are state-owned enterprises, and we have complete separation between the rate regulator and between the other regulators, all sorts of regulators, and a complete separation between the rate regulator and between the ownership entitled body, which is the GC. I think that when you consider the state as an owner, it is a little bit different from other owners of companies. So I think that of course you must give all the details about the related parties in the notes, but it shouldn't affect the measurement and the recognition of the rate regulation. I think it's completely separate. I think in most of the countries, as we know.
So you're saying that in Israel, where there is state ownership mm-hmm. of the rate-regulated entities, a requirement for the rate-setting body to be independent, to you know, separate, that would work because there is separation.
It works.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Leonardo.
Okay. I like this part of the definition here.
working in the interest of the customers and to ensure the overall financial viability of the entity. I don't think that a self-regulated company attend this criteria here. I don't think that a self-regulated company is working protecting the interest of the customers. So I'm not sure. So I think that this definition here, maybe the question of independence can be achieved in this part of the definition.
PK.
Other than North America, I want to understand, if possible, I think we heard really a little bit on the Israel activity.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing is that between the supplier, whoever that is, and the ultimate customer, there is a body in between that is needed to make this work. That's what I'm hearing. Most of you are saying that. In the morning when Patricia straightened me out, we were having a little bit of a discussion about the airport authority and airlines. In that case scenario, I think Tim is not here, thanks, to elaborate it, but there is no third party in between the party. Do we want to eliminate those entities? And I just wanted to get some clarity on that. Can I talk now, Ms. Patricia, on this issue, or you want to speak?
Just kidding.
Sandbox it. Yeah.
My recollection on NAV Canada, the company that you're mentioning, and there's also another one I was mentioning in New Brunswick, another utility. My recollection is those two entities have been created by a law. It's unclear, and they have legal letters. It's unclear if there's any shareholders. They have no return. So we're saying it's just a cost base. They don't have any return. They don't give any dividend. It's a cost. There's a governing body. They call themselves commissioners. They are regulating the entity. They're fixing the price, and they move on. But to me, although they seem to be two parties, there's no shareholders.
No,
and these guys, you have management on one side and you have the commissioners on the other side, although they are governing the entity,
It's a very strange one,
I'm not talking about those entities. I'm talking about, in the morning, what I thought was airport authority for landing planes.
Okay.
That's a scenario because we can spread it outside the North America, or especially Canada, and go to the rest of the world for other industries. So by inserting a body in between, are we eliminating some of those things which should be within the scope? That's my question, basically. Because the airport authority, I understand, is two-party, not a three-party transaction.
Yeah, there's too much involvement there, but I can't speak to that one. So I don't know, Richard, if you have any comments.
Jesus, would you be able to speak to that from?
Yeah, he has that.
Lily volunteered.
I don't think that we are eliminating some of the components with the scope, but I think that most of the, when there is a state-owned enterprise, it has a lot of regulators. Most of the times, it is the regulator who acts as the right regulator for the stability and availability of the utility, and there is the regulator who acts as the owner, and there is the regulators who budget the entity, and the regulator who makes the contract in behalf of the country. And I said earlier this day in Israel, the electricity company has about 15 regulators that it had to deal with. So it doesn't make the scope narrower, but it doesn't infect the scope of our work, in my opinion. But I think that if there is special relations between the entity and the regulator, and not the state, then it creates another economic situation which is not in the scope of regulation. That's what I think.
in the case of airports here in the UK, the cap of the tariff is fixed by the regulator, and there is a negotiation between the airport and the airlines how allocate a tariff to different parts. For example, you have a fee for landing, another fee for parking per airplane, and for departure you are charging a fee per person. Your client, from the point of view of the airport, are the airlines. Yeah, and then the airlines then charge the cost of the airport to the user, so the people are flying there.
Jane?
Thank you. That might be a useful point there, because what I heard from you, Jesus, was that there's a regulator that sets the overall tariff, but then there's some negotiation of the individual components of a price.
Yes, the allocation of the global fee to different components. That's rated, for example, for, you say, parking or landing or a number of passengers departing.
But that's not different than the electricity industry. I suppose when you negotiate your revenue, after that you turn around, you have your different class of customers. The small one, the bigger one, and then...
For example, in the case of the airports, the tariffs depends per plane will be affected, for example, for the emissions of CO2. And planes with higher emissions have higher tariffs. So it's an incentive that is established by the government. They say you have to increase the tariffs that you are charging to the planes that are producing more emissions. But at the end of the day, you have the global tariff that is, as I say, split between different countries.
Does the body that sets that global tariff also have to approve the split?
No, they fix the overall tariff and then you discuss with the airline to discuss that split.
Who moderates that? Who chairs that discussion?
The discussion. It's a discussion between airlines and the airport.
And if they can't agree, who decides?
If there is not an agreement, they will have a discussion with the regulator. But at the end of the day, they have to find an agreement because there is a global tariff that has to be charged.
Because, Michelle, again, kind of similar, at least in the U.S., the regulators are very involved in the rate design.
Exactly, in Canada as well. They don't get involved in the allocation, and you would have the interveners as well that chip in.
But the regulator is really...
Yes.
Karen wants to come in and explain to us how they do it correctly in Canada.
Probably wrong, but there is the airport model that is being discussed. We do actually use it because a large number of our rate proceedings go into settlement. So in order to avoid the costly cost of service hearing, we often let the parties, meaning the applicant and the various different representatives of all the customer classes, so large industrial, vulnerable energy, they will go into a room and they will negotiate revenue requirement cost items as well as the rate design, which takes the revenue requirement and carves it up between the different rate classes. If they cannot settle on all of the issues that are at or subject to the filing, then they bring it back and it's formally adjudicated by the board. In the case of a settlement, we don't go in and delve into each particular point. We accept the settlements as a whole, and that's really just to avoid a costly hearing. So the model that he's describing does exist within the utility framework as well. Maybe one of the ways we could sort of back the conversation up and is simply just eliminate the notion that the party between the customer and the utility maybe need not be described formally as independent, but that they have the role or obligation to try and set prices that are in the public interest. So while a board of an entity like NAVCAN may, be conflicted, they nevertheless have the public obligation. It's almost like, securities regulations, people that are selling still have a fiduciary duty to do, or the best interest, notwithstanding the fact that they're conflicted. So maybe for the purposes of the definition of who the regulator is, we can simply remove the word independent, but leave in the notion of the public interest.
Okay. And at this point, I don't want to disrupt the conversation, but just so that you keep on track with the papers, we've drifted very nicely and seamlessly into paper 6D, where, again, part of the question of the scope, and I think I know what the answer is because of the conversation that's gone so far, but just to help focus any further comments that we've got. Again, the original definition that we've been working with through the previous project is that the rate regulator sets a price that binds the customer, so the customer really doesn't have an opportunity to negotiate. And part of our question is whether we should change that scope to reflect some of the schemes that we've seen through the request for information responses, where it seems it's not just airports, as Karen's just mentioned, there are some aspects of utilities where the rate regulator sets the overall framework, if you like, so that the revenue recognition is normally in terms of the total revenue, but then there is some scope for the supplier to negotiate with particular customers or groups of customers or their representatives to then break down the scope. So break down that overall revenue requirement tariffs for individual types of customers. And I just wanted to gauge your opinion as to whether that negotiation or the ability to negotiate an individual price with a customer should knock out of scope these sorts of arrangements, or whether you do see it just as a separate element of rate regulation that should still be in the scope of our project, albeit, and then secondly, do we actually need to think differently about these, or is it just another part of a mechanism that would influence measurement rather than the actual scope of the project?
As a clarifying question, I think implicit in that, I think, is that there's still a true up to the overall tip requirement in some way. So if the entity can't get to a settlement with everybody to add up, I think one of the examples we were using, then you can go back and get the regulator to come in and mandate it, force it. Because even in a settlement, in my experience in the U.S., if the settlement was just clearly preferential to one group versus another, the regulator is going to step in and not approve the settlement. So the regulator has the final authority at the end of the day, and the tariffs are approved by the regulator, and the customer, once approved by the regulator, has to accept it, is my experience. So, but if I'm hearing that, well, the customer isn't really bound unless the customer agrees, and then the entity has no other recourse, then I think we're dramatically changing the scope. But
That was exactly the point that I wanted to explore here as to, well, are the schemes in existence that do allow that greater possibility that the customer has the final say, or are the schemes that we're all thinking about that ought to be within scope the ones where the rate regulator is the final arbiter if there is no agreed settlement within the total?
Karen, do you want to clarify?
Sure. I think in all instances, the regulator holds the final approval, and there can be no rate charged to a customer unless the regulator has approved it. So notwithstanding the mechanism that was used to determine the rate or determine what the rate costs are that go into the rate-making process, regulator always has the final approval of those rates. And they have the capacity to bind the customer.
Mary?
I think maybe question about whether this exists or not, which is in a setting where there is substantive rate regulation, are there circumstances in which that's viewed as the maximum price so that having agreed via rate-setting mechanism a price of X, that Duane, you might be able to go out and negotiate with a specific customer a discount to that price, perhaps based on volume or, you know, when timing or, you know, some other feature that makes it attractive to you to reach an individual agreement. And, you know, are there, maybe less so in the North American context elsewhere, are there scenarios that people think we should be thinking of as similar to the ones we've been discussing, where the company can, without the regulator's approval, agree maybe discounts or perhaps it's, you know, a surcharge if somebody wants some kind of premium capacity or priority or something like that. Or with that ability to negotiate individually with customers as a supplement to the rate setting mechanism take you out of what we've been discussing?
Your first point on, if I was hearing a price cap,
yeah,
like the usury laws on interest rates that banks can charge or credit card companies can charge, is, which would be different than if the government said this is the interest rate you should charge, but you can negotiate something lower.
Rate mechanism says, okay, based, whether it's cost-based, incentive-based, et cetera, says, all right, here are four classes of customers, here's the rate per class. But you really, really care for one reason or another about doing business with Amaro. Would you be able to go out and negotiate a one-off deal with him? And if you can, with Amaro having full knowledge of what's been agreed, you know, for the four classes of customers, if you are allowed to, should that take you out of the bucket that everybody who cannot negotiate that one-off deal has been put into? It's not quite, this is the cap and you can negotiate from there. I don't know. Does that, if it's an entirely hypothetical, let's not waste time on it. I don't know if around the world that comes up, the ability to negotiate with a single customer.
I would suggest that once the regulator has approved for that class of customers, because remember that those different classes of customers are represented in the rate hearing itself. So they've had the ability to do that negotiation already. And so if the regulator has said that it costs X for that particular class of customer, that's the price. Now, if an individual utility decided to charge them less, that cost would go to them. That cost would not be picked up by the other customers.
But you think the ability to agree that lower cost on the basis that it's not passed on shouldn't differentiate that entity from the ones who cannot.
Well, I would say that is not regulated. It's non-regulated if they decide to do that. So that would not be within the scope.
Isn't that what we heard Katie talk about just before lunch with the oil transmission companies?
Yeah, gas transmission.
The gas.
They came out of 71 then 10 years later when they stopped discounting.
But they went back. So he was saying they came back and they went back.
So, Karen, did you want to come in?
I was just going to ask Brian Craig if he's still in the room to speak. I know with respect to the question that I think Marie asked specifically, and again, my memory is a little bit dicey on this, but if Brian is still there, he can answer. FERC does allow a maximum rate on natural gas interstate pipelines at a maximum, and they do have non-discriminatory transparent processes to allow for discounting.
Right. In the gas industry, hardly anybody is charging the max rate. Most of the pipeline carriers are charging discounted rates. And that's primarily because the throughput, they want to get the business. But that's the way the system has evolved over the past 10 or 15 years.
So do you see them as being in the same bucket as the other rate-regulated entities that we've been talking about? Or because they're not hitting the cap, do you think that they are a distinct bucket?
They still have to come in because some of their costs, they got hybrid rates. You can discount on the commodity, but you still got that transmission that they got to pay for, and they will often come in for that on the cost of service rate making, which will have the trackers or the reconciliation accounts to catch costs that previously had not been recovered.
Does it make sense to separate and say that piece belongs in the bucket we've been talking about, and the piece that's subject to discounts is outside, or is that just nonsensical and you got to do a predominant nature?
I wouldn't separate it, but then again, I'm the regulator. I think it's best for the regulated entities to opine upon that. But unfortunately, Joan Dreskin Flaminga is not here. That handle a lot of the gas pipelines in our area.
So I think I'm somewhat confused now. I'm not sure that I understand, Brian, what you just explained and how that differs from what Casey, and it's too bad he's gone, was saying before lunch about them coming out of rate regulation when they started discounting from their approved fees.
Sounds like they discounted all of their business.
Yes, and then Casey also said they came back under regulation 10 years later, which they did.
I mean, I think this is an important point to explore.
Right.
Because, again, it's are we talking about bringing the entity in scope or a general activity in scope or a business segment in scope, or is it the particular revenue streams, the particular activities that are regulated? So I see this as quite an important part of the debate on the scope.
Paragraph 3 currently defines it as the activity.
Prices are an important part.
Is that?
Am I sick?
Sorry, is that John?
Hello?
Hello?
This is Sherm Myers in New York. I think that prices that bind are an important part. I think that's a critical differentiation between the cooperatives that you've talked about. They can set prices, but they don't bind. In a previous life, I was an accountant and had responsibility for a FERC-regulated pipeline that couldn't charge the rates that would recover costs, and as a result, it didn't apply regulatory accounting. And in my experience as an analyst, I haven't seen a lot of interstate pipelines that are just that, using regulatory accounting, because they are more in a competitive position.
Competition.
So to me, the prices that bind, set by whether it's the board or the an outside party, is a critical factor.
Good. Thank you for that, Jim. We thought you were gone, but we're glad you're still here.
Yes.
I tried to speak a couple times, but I couldn't get in.
I apologize.
No, it's not your fault.
Jacob?
Maybe in South Africa, what they do is that we have special contracts, but they need to be approved by the regulator. So my company can't just approve a tariff. They have to get approval. And secondly, they treat it separately in a distinct bucket. So basically, you when you work out the tariff, you will keep, because now you know in terms of that tariff, in our case, they work basically for aluminium smelters where you have some embedded derivatives. So you can work out the price and then the revenue is worked out as the balancing figure. So, but you, in the end, when you work out the other revenue, you just add this together. So it's basically separated.
June?
Okay. Thanks very much for that. And that's really, really helpful to sort of clarify some uncertainty about that. Now, on good track, we're now reaching paper 6E, which is our final scope issue of today. And I'm quite conscious that I'm going to look at Pascal here, because I know that she's passionate, as is Jesus. So we've kind of got a 15-minute slot for this, and I know people have got flights to go home to. The intention of raising this paper was not to bottom out the whole discussion on the interaction between IFRIC 12 and rate regulation. It was really to just set it up with an initial discussion, and we will definitely come back at a later stage. The reason for raising it here, and it's a slightly longer paper because there's quite a long extract from IFRIC 12 been put in here specifically for those of you that are not too familiar with it. But IFRIC 12 deals with service concession arrangements. And part of the introduction into IFRIC 12 define some typical characteristics of service concession arrangements, or sometimes they're called public-private partnerships or other terminology. But basically these characteristics these arrangements are trying to encourage more private sector investment in public services. It's a way of governments trying to share some of the load where they can't get financing, so they'll use the private sector. But a lot of the description of the characteristics of these service concession arrangements is it involves public service, it involves a government body that will get involved in setting performance levels, the type of infrastructure that's required to carry out the public service, and will, as part of the arrangement, set the tariff and the mechanism for changes in that tariff during the period of the concession arrangement. And so we have had quite a lot of comments, both from the previous project and in some of the requests for information and at other events or other conversations, to say how will this interact if the ISB produce some guidance that may well be similar to the US GAAP or the Canadian GAAP guidance, where we can recognise regulatory items. How does it interact with IFRIC 12? And the mechanism in IFRIC 12, the scope of IFRIC 12, is looking at those arrangements where the infrastructure is controlled by the government body. So at the end of the concession arrangement, the residual interest goes back to the government body. So there's management's ability during the period from the supplier or the operator, but at the end, control is with the grantor or the government body. IFRIC 12 basically says you don't put the infrastructure on your balance sheet if you're the operator, because that is the government's asset. Instead, you recognise some other sort of asset depending on the type of arrangement that you're in. And the models that are set out says that if the arrangement gives you a right to recover the costs that you're going to incur, both capital or operating costs, by charging users of the service or users of the infrastructure, then that would lead you to recognise an intangible asset on your balance sheet, because you've got a licence to operate for the period and the ability to recover the costs that you're incurring, plus a targeted return. Alternatively, some of these concession arrangements, the government body will guarantee a level of return. It may well be that you still charge the customers, and the mechanism for getting the cash flows is that you charge the customers, but the guarantee means that if the demand falls and you can't recover those anticipated costs through the charges to the customers, you can recover it directly from the government. And there is a question then over, is there an overlap, or how would the overlap work out? If you've got a service concession arrangement that is also classified as being a rate-regulated activity, and I guess the first question that's on the paper is, do you agree that these service concession arrangements and the characters will pull you into the scope? Also, we're looking in the questions here about your experiences, and we've heard quite a bit about that already today, so perhaps we can focus on question one, and in particular question three, if you do agree that service concession arrangements generally would be rate-regulated activities, do you think we should be looking again at IFRIC 12 and perhaps seeing if we can widen the scope of IFRIC 12 to pull in rate regulation, or do we work at it the other way around, focus on rate regulation and then see if IFRIC 12 pulls in afterwards?
It is.
As you said, in IFRIC 12 you had two different models. One is the financial asset model. And I think that financial asset model is not a regulated activity, because at the end of the day you had a right to receive cash, and a conditional right to receive cash from the government. you are some type of payment subject to the availability of the asset. So in the case of the financial asset model, you don't have a rate regulated activity because you the rates have not impact in the business, because at the end of the day, the government is paying and it's paying a fixed amount that is recognized as a financial asset. So the discussion of the interaction between regulated activities and IFRIC 12 is with a tangible asset model. And I think that in this case, as one of the key issues is that the tariffs are fixed by the regulator, clearly all the intangible asset model are also regulated activities. So here the connection between the two projects is clear. From my point of view, it's not necessary to reopen IFRIC 12. I think IFRIC 12 is working okay, I think, but also it's not necessary to reopen IFRIC 12. Yes, I think as intangible asset models are regulated activities, when you are discussing regulated activities and you conclude which are the implications of regulated activity, you will have to analyze which is the implication within IFRIC 12. Because, as I said, I think all the intangible asset models are clearly regulated activities. So my proposal should be we can analyze the regulated activity, and when we have a clear position, we will analyze which is the impact to the intangible asset model.
Fantastic, thank you.
Pascal, you have?
It's a pragmatic proposal. Because I don't know, it took maybe you remember, 4 years to issue, I think, 4 years? Quite a long time. So I don't know if that makes it reasonable to reopen IFRIC 12.
So we were discussing more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The discussion began in 2002.
Yeah. But it was a long discussion.
Yes.
And but the point is that I agree that overlap is it's IFRIC 12 concession arrangements are some kind of regulation. I think major difference is that you have a timing delay. You have the contract is supposed to end, and you have to give it back. And after you have different, I know that in Spain, for example, we have some water business in Spain. Some are analyzed as IFRIC 12, and so are not, because in some countries or in some states, you have to reopen the discussion, and sometimes you just get automatic renewal and so on. So it's very difficult, even and you cannot just stick to the legal environment, because and in France, on the other side, we have some regulated business, which is accounted for as tangible assets, but the legal environment is concessions arrangements. So that's really a mess. No, because that's the point, that legal environment is not IFRS. So we have some words, and I think it's a comment which was made at that time, that concession arrangement, if you take the different countries, concession arrangement are different type of legal arrangements. So I think it's pragmatic. But again, I think 12 is really principle-based, is holistic approach, and go back to revenue recognition, to other standards. It's an interpretation. So I think once we'll get with one standard on regulated activities, but it will be a key to be sure that it will not create some differences in application and IFRIC 12 and so on.
That's here.
But what about leases?
Leonardo.
Okay. I agree that IFRIC 12 is an important issue, but I'm a little concerned with the scope of the project, okay? Because if we expand the scope to treat everything about the rate regulation issues, I'm not sure that we will be or we will be able to finish to attend the deadline in 2015. So there are other questions related to FRIP 12 that maybe we could treat, we could discuss in other projects. I'm not sure.
Yes, if I may, I'm concerned with the LIS project because we have some, I think you mentioned, somebody mentioned PFI, or private-public arrangements. And so we have some public-private arrangements in, for example, for hospitals, for lighting in the street, for security in prisons, in jails, and systems. And we always ask the question whether it's public service or not public service. So that's one difficulty of application of Aspect 12. And so, but usually, what we do, it's a pragmatic application, I would say. I don't know if it's compliant with IFS, but it's what we do. Just we analyze the contract to assess whether we have some risk or not. And one, it's, I mentioned lighting in the street and stuff like that. Usually we end up with a financial asset. So for us, there is no, it's only theory to get to a financial asset. We have two ways, IFRIC 12 or IFRIC 4, but we end up with a financial as a financial asset. So I think maybe that it's not direct question with the VIT regulation project, but if we keep IFRIC 12 and we keep the financial asset for IFRIC 12, I think we have to be consistent with IFRIC 4 today, and that's one other question for us. In some, I don't know if it's public service, I don't know if it's retrogression, but it's all for private public initiative for PFIs. And we have a lot. I know in UK, we have some waste business in UK, and we have a lot of PFIs in France too.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Since you asked for opinions on your question one, do you agree that service concessions are rate regulated? I'll give you my it depends answer. I think it depends on who takes what risks. If the contract says that it's a cost recovery, I'm going to be guaranteed, and there's a regulator that will guarantee that I get those from whomever it may be. But if I, as a private entity, accept risks of cost recovery that I think I'll get, wouldn't be.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that was Jesus follows pretty much along that line. With the
I didn't catch the question, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay, it was about the financial versus
non-financial. Yeah. So just slightly rephrase, who takes the risk if it's a guaranteed return or not. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I can't believe that we've now reached 3:45 and we're on schedule with our agenda, which is very impressive. So thank you very much for that. And also thank you very, very much for your input today. It's been absolutely tremendous. And it's given me lots of things to think about. And I've heard lots of stuff today, which I have to say, a lot of it I've heard before, but I've heard it in a very different context, and the ability to get different sides of it in the same room has been tremendously helpful in moving things along.